We will officially call the board meeting to order at 5:39 PM. Christy, do you want me to run with it or do you want to take it?
Oh, no, please go ahead.
Okay. No, <it's>
if you're going to ask.
Short, right? Okay. Do I have a motion to approve tonight's board agenda?
I'll move to approve tonight's board agenda.
Thank you. I have a first. Do I have a second?
Second, Carla.
Carla, I have a first and a second. Any discussion? Okay, I'm going for the roll call vote. Christy?
Yes.
Carla?
Yes.
Dixie?
Yes.
Denise?
Yes.
Okay, motion carries with four roll call votes. Any public comment? I'm going to proxy for El Centro and say none.
I'm going to say the same for San Bernardino. Nothing here.
Okay, thank you. Moving on to the agenda action items. We had an approval of our last board meeting's minutes, April 5th, 2022. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
This is Christy. I'll move to approve the April 5th, 2022 minutes.
Thank you. Do I have a second?
I'll second, Dixie.
Dixie, I have a first and I have a second. Any discussion? Hearing none, I'll go for the roll call vote. Christy?
Yes.
Carla?
Yeah.
Denise?
Yes.
Dixie?
Yes.
Motion carries with four roll call votes. Next is approval of virtual meetings, so we can continue our virtual meetings on into May. Do I have an approval to do to approve that action?
Move to approve.
I have a first, Carla. Do I have a second?
I'll second. Denise.
I have a first and a second. Any discussion?
One question about that. Now that the mask mandates are being released, and how long is this option available through the Brown Act?
They have not shared that it's been retracted as of yet, to my knowledge. So my guess is probably they'll look at it begin July for the next fiscal year, next school year, to see if they're going to want to go ahead and extend it.
Right.
Or if he's going to continue to call, I guess the governor could call anything an emergency at that point.
I know where I work, the board and committee meetings, no one, they want to keep it virtual or have the hybrid. So we're madly trying to establish satellite places so that when we, satellite locations, kind of like we do in normal time, so that people still have that option. But members of the public really love it, because they can attend and be part of it, whereas they probably wouldn't drive down to, the transportation authority to participate. So, okay.
I know. I feel like there's definitely pros and cons. I feel like you don't have to, like, the driving time, it's more accessible.
Yeah.
It definitely has its pros and cons. I know that there's an argument to be said about physical presence, mm-hmm. as well. So
yeah. Okay, thank you.
You are welcome. I have a first and I have a second. We did have some discussion. I'm going to go for the vote. Carla?
Yes.
Denise?
Yes.
Dixie?
Yes.
Christy?
Yes.
Motion carries with four roll call votes. I almost forgot my order of the Brown Act. I'm like, we are on the vote, right? My goodness. Okay, the next is our approval of the independent auditor for 2021 to 2022, which is this year. Thank you, Carla, for all of your research. I know that there was a question on whether or not or how often we can actually maintain the same auditor. And it appears that both with Carla, your findings, as well as based on my correspondence from Kevin, which is our current auditor, that they really recommend a switching up of the partners. And per Kevin's email, he shared that since he has already done it for quite some time with us, he will be recommending a different partner with his firm this year. So I think we were able to answer all of the questions that we had brought before at our last meeting. And now I'm looking for a motion to approve the independent auditor for 2021 to 2022.
I move to approve the auditor.
I'll second. This is Christy.
First, the second. Any discussion? Hearing none, I'm going to call for the vote. Carla?
Yes.
Christy?
Yes.
Denise?
Yes.
Indeed. Dixie?
Yes.
Motion carries with 4 roll call votes. Thank you. The next topic is our meeting dates for May. So board members, if I may just preference, this is going to be our really busy time again for us. This is when we're putting together the budget for next year, as well as the LCAP, our local control accountability plan. We're required for that to do 2 meetings, one essentially a public meeting, and then on the second meeting, we do the official vote. So we've got to time it as such where we have 2 meetings, which are 72 hours apart. Because of the amount of work that is going into this, our current board meeting is scheduled for May 3rd. I know for sure that both schools will not have it done by May 3rd, just between the budget and the LCAP, those hundreds and pages of documents, and there's additional requirements that the CDE has placed on us with the LCAP this year. Also, on the other side, our San Bernardino authorizer wants all of this done by June 1st. Rather than the typical June 30th, they're asking for it a full month and ahead of everybody else. Given that, I wanted to propose if we could potentially move our May 3rd meeting out to allow us enough time to at least prepare the documents for the first part, the public hearing, and then we could have the second meeting in May for the approval of those documents, and then be able to be responsive to San Bernardino's deadline of June 1st. I also want to share, last year we began the process of asking to have our back office services reviewed. So we have been getting lots and lots of quotes. We've been having, I want to say Zoom interviews and telephone interviews, and then they're providing us with quotes. I've asked all of the ones that are interested in giving us quotes to do so by next week. So then that will give us an opportunity to review them. And then if I know some of board members, you had indicated you'd like to be part of that process. And then I thought maybe out of the top 2, then we could call the top 2 back and have a more, another interview with those, and maybe those board members that wanted to join us could be a part of that role, and then be able to also bring a recommendation for back office to you by the end of May as well. A lot of them are saying they would like obviously as much time as possible for the transition, but also at the very least a whole month of time at least to do the transition. So with that in mind, what I would propose is if we could move our 2 May board meetings back as far as possible, just to give the principals and myself time to finish working on the budget and the LCAP to be able to present to you in a public hearing. And then ultimately it has to be 3 days later in between to have the vote. Shannon, do you have anything to add to that? I know you've been working closely on the new LCAP version, and maybe I left something out with that might be important to mention as well.
No, I think you definitely covered it. It's just with the amount asked of us by the state with the LCAP, I think it's physically impossible to get it done by the first week of May. So we would need that extra time. And it also, you know, in order to be able to have those two meetings at least 72 hours apart.
So what I could propose, and board members, you tell me, we could propose again, June 1st is the date that we have to absolutely drop dead, get it to San Bernardino. So we could even move the public hearing out to May 24, and then go through the majority of the budget, the majority of the LCAP, and then we could vote potentially on May 31st. I think that's right after Memorial Day though. So I don't know if that's Memorial Day is May 30. So I don't know if having a meeting on May 31st, the day after Memorial Day, is problematic for everybody to approve it. But that would probably give us the most time to be able to pull all of that together.
So our two May meetings, assuming we're going with two meetings, one on the 24th, one on the 31st.
Yes, that's what I would propose.
Okay. I don't have any issue with those dates.
I'm good with that.
Those dates work for me also, Doreen.
Perfect. And I'm okay with that too, Dixie.
Perfect. And Shannon, does that feel good to you? Because I know you have a lot of work in the LCAP as well.
We can do it.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, then if I can get a motion to approve our board meeting changed dates to May 24, 2022, as the first May meeting, and then May 31st, 2022 as the second May meeting at 5:30.
Well, propose to move the meeting date as presented, the 24th and the 31st.
Thank you. I have a first. Second. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I'll second. This is Christy.
Thank you, Christy. Okay, I have a first. I have a second. Any discussion? Okay, hearing none, I'll call for the roll call vote. Carla?
Yes.
Christy?
Yes.
Dixie?
Yes.
And Denise?
Yes.
Okay, motion carries with the change in meeting dates. Thank you, board members. It's much appreciated. We know the LCAP and the budget are going to be a tremendous amount of work. So much appreciated. Okay, well, that concludes actually our agenda action items. And the only other item on our agenda for this evening is our well-waited for charter school finance training. So I know a lot of us have been asking for that. So I'm excited, and I do see that Mr. Dennison is here. We had said about 6 o'clock, but I think if everybody's okay, I know it's 5:52. We could begin a few minutes earlier, if that's all right with the board members. We can roll right into it. And if Mr. Dennison, if you're good with that,
sounds good.
Okay, all right, board members. As I mentioned earlier, I had when the request had come in for finance training, I had shared with you that when I was first new to all of this, I had met Mr. Dennison, and man, he had taken such a complex topic and allowed me to understand it. So I'm so excited to have him here with us this evening and to be able to present. Mr. Dennison, I will not steal your thunder. I know that you have so much experience in the charter world as well with charter finance. I'll let you do that as far as your introduction goes. Again, welcome to our meeting. We have Ms. Carla Kuntz, who has been on the board for a very long time, I think way back when El Centro was established. She is our, I'll let her introduce her background as well. And we have Ms. Harris, who has also been with us for a very long time.
Hello.
As well. And Ms. Dixie. And then Miss Denise, who might need to shuffle off, but that's okay. So we've got our four board members here. And with that, I will turn it over to you. I won't take any more of our time.
Great.
Well, good evening, everybody. Just want to say it's great to see you again, Doreen, after many, many years. As she mentioned, she and I worked together a little bit during the founding of Bollington, like way back in the dark ages. So great to see you, and great that you're still doing great work for kids. So just a couple sentences about myself. I've been involved with charter schools for the last 20 years now. And so I helped start a charter school in Oakland. I live near Oakland. And then I helped other people start charter schools for probably about 10 years. And now I effectively, I'm kind of a CFO type for charter schools. And I work with Charter School Management Corporation, which is the business back office provider for Bollington. So as I understand it, you all would like what I would call kind of charter school finance 101 level kind of overview of how charter school funding works and critical aspects. So I'll run through that. And please know that I'm fine with you all interrupting me anytime with any questions that you may have or clarifications. I'm fine with that, or we can wait to the end, whatever you prefer. So feel free to do so. So why don't I go ahead and share my screen?
Yes, you should be able to share.
Yes, great. Thank you. Good. Okay. Good. I am ready to go. Okay. So just, you know, and we'll see how long this ends up taking. It'll probably depend upon how many questions we have and whatnot. But overall, I thought this could take roughly 45 minutes. Maybe it'll be less or more. The goals for this presentation: review revenue programs. I think we'll probably spend the bulk of our time on those aspects there. We'll talk just broadly speaking about cash flow and when charter schools tend to get their money, because that can be important. I do see that Bollington does have a decent amount of cash reserves, in my opinion. So thankfully, we are not living hand to mouth, so to speak, but I think it's still important to have a big picture understanding of how we get our money and when. A few items just, you know, what I would call budgeting pointers, perhaps, as we get into the budgeting, you know, the height of the budgeting season here, with an eye towards the July 1st budget that is required for the school. And then a quick overview on some common recommended financial reports that maybe you are already seeing. They might look familiar to you. So, and again, feel free to interrupt at any time with questions. The first item I wanted to start with is what's called average daily attendance. Some of you might have heard this quite a bit. Some of you might have heard it and not really ever knew really what it was. It's very critical and foundational for charter school finance. So I wanted to start here. So because this average daily attendance, it's nearly always referred to as ADA, underlies nearly every state revenue program. And it's not the same as enrollment. I think it's ADA is always lower. And to me, it's helpful to just think of a concrete example. If you have 100 students enrolled in your school, but on average only 95 are in school on a particular day because say five are sick per day, then you have 95 average daily attendance, or ADA, and you will most importantly get paid on the basis of the 95, not the 100. So to emphasize, you know, and I agree with this, I'm glad that our state emphasizes the need not to have kids quote unquote signed up, in other words, enrolled in the school, but to actually be in school on a day-to-day basis, doing work and learning. So this average daily attendance aspect can be critical, and even seemingly small differences here, say the difference, you know, probably an average ADA percentage versus enrollment is probably about, you know, you tend to have about 95% enrollment or so. Really good schools can get up to, you know, 97% if they're usually serving the younger grades in particular, and try to do a very good job of following up on attendance and making sure that everyone understands how important ADA is and getting kids in school. And down to a dropout recovery program might have, you know, 80% ADA. So they, on average, only 80% of their kids are in school on any particular day. So this can vary quite a bit. And just the difference from, say, 96 down to 95%, which could easily happen if you're not really following up and paying attention to daily attendance, that can have a pretty big funding effect upon your school. So want to bring that up. We'll bring up, so ADA gets reported out in these periods. That's the last bullet that's listed, this period one, period two, and period final, sometimes called annual. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Again, that's to me a fairly critical aspect that I think board members should know about since it underlies our funding, so foundation. Okay, so far and away, our largest funding program is called the Local Control Funding Formula, or LCFF. And the LCFF is new-ish. It's probably about, 8 years now. It was really kind of a crowning achievement or an important item to Governor Brown, former Governor Brown. So that happened during his tenure. So the Local Control Funding Formula is broken up and it's made up of three different subpots of funding. These three subpots, unless you have questions about it, I probably won't spend too much time on these different pots that make up the total LCFF. Just know that there is a little bit of a cash flow difference between the three items, the three subpots. And so if we were living more hand to mouth than I think we are, this might become important. And you might hear this terminology, the in-lieu property tax versus state aid versus EPA or education protection account. But overall, it's not, it really only affects us because there's a cash flow timing difference between them. So this LCFF grant in total provides the bulk of nearly all schools' funding, and it's usually in the 80 to 90% range, and it looked like it was in that range for us. So it's far and away where most of our revenue comes in. Just as
a quick question, if you don't mind.
No, I'm glad you're interrupting. Go ahead.
Thank you. I don't want to be rude.
No, you're not.
So all three of those components are based on ADA. Is that correct?
That is exactly right. And weren't you listening? That is exactly right.
Yeah. Everything. Okay.
Yeah. So this one and almost all the ones that I'll probably go over are going to be based upon that average daily attendance. So exactly right. Okay. So this LCFF grant makes up the bulk, in the 80-90% range, as I mentioned. So that's why, it's critically important. And it is indeed based upon average daily attendance as reported out via those P1 and P2 time periods that, again, I'll talk about a little bit later. Okay, other state revenue programs, the lottery. So the California State Lottery, if you don't know, actually most of those funds, most of those profits, I really should say, go towards funding public education. So, actually, I'm not a real fan of the lottery in general, but I guess if it gives us money, I start becoming a reluctant fan. It's currently about $228 per, and this is the only funding program that is not going to be based upon what's called P2. This one is based upon P final, technically, which is all of our average daily attendance for all of our instructional days throughout the year. So that's what P final means. And this is the only funding program that is dependent upon it. Usually this is not going to be a big difference here between this P final and whatever everyone else is based upon, but I just wanted to give you that little detail there. The next program is called the Mandate Block Grant. It's a small amount, and the premise behind this program is if the state requires another governmental entity to do something, the state has to pay for it, and that's called a mandate. So the state is mandating, in this case, that public education schools and school districts and charter schools have to, say, test the hearing and sight of students or, those sorts of items. And so to pay for that, there used to be a reimbursement process, which was very onerous and time consuming and far behind. And now they just give kind of a block grant amount for all this. And it's about $48 per 9-12 ADA and a smaller amount for the younger grades. Special education, it looks like we are, I believe, in a special education local plan area. And so therefore we get special education funding directly. And that's fine. We, in exchange for getting the funding, effectively mostly a pass-through from the state and federal sources down to this, almost like this county-level entity called a SELPA. And in exchange for getting that money, we are on the hook for all special education services. So for this year, the state is giving us about $715 per ADA, and that's every ADA, not special education ADA or anything like that. There's also a federal component we'll talk about a little bit, and also there can be mental health pieces also, which are additional buckets. But this is the largest one, the $715. The amount for next year, by the way, is proposed to be, I believe it's 810. So proposed to go up by a significant amount. I would say Gavin Newsom wants to give more money for special education in particular, and also for another state funding program called the Expanded Learning Opportunity Program, which perhaps we'll talk about in just a second.
And just to clarify, for since we have our two charter schools now, our El Centro is serves as their standalone SELPA, so we get the revenue from for special education directly, where we provide all our services. Unlike that, though, our San Bernardino is where a school is a district, so they actually, board members, I know we've talked about this a little bit, they maintain all the revenue, but they provide our services, and then in addition to that, they charge us an encroachment fee. So a lot of times we see that happening at the end of the year.
Thank you for that clarification. I checked one, but I guess I assume both were the same. So thank you for saying.
No, that's okay. Our San Bernardino is our newest one for you, Mr. Dennison.
Great. Yes, I wasn't familiar with that one. Okay, great. So that's special education quickly. And then, so those are the, you know, not all, but those are the largest state funding sources on an ongoing basis. Now I'm turning to federal. The federal revenues and really the largest federal source of funds for us is called, is Title I. There are other Title programs, but Title I is the largest one. Title I is for, and we receive funding based upon our free reduced count. And so maybe I should just pause there. Probably everyone is familiar with this, but just in case, there's always been this Title I federal program that gives additional money based upon low socioeconomic status of students. So they will give extra money for each kid that would otherwise qualify for, say, a free lunch or a reduced price lunch. In relatively recent years, and with the move to this local control funding formula at the state level, now the state is you know, radically at this point, providing additional funding for those same sorts of students. And in addition, not only free reduced level students, but also English language learners and foster youth. And so that combined amount at the state level, for us, but for state funding purposes, of free reduced plus English language learners plus foster youth, and one kid can only count once, even if they are both free reduced and English language learner, by the way. So it's called the unduplicated count. So this unduplicated count, the state is giving a lot more money for. There is a supplemental amount of money of 20% for each of those kids. And in addition, if we add up, if our unduplicated count adds up to 55% or greater, they will give us a 65%, I believe it is, funding bonus for each of those kids that's over that 55% funding threshold. So the long and short of it is that if we have a very high percentage of unduplicated kids, and I believe we do, I'm sorry, actually, Doreen, what is our approximate percentages for our two sites of unduplicated students? Do you happen to know that?
So San Bernardino is in the high 90s.
Yes.
And El Centro is in the 80s.
Okay, great. Well, so those are both very high counts. And the good news to that is that that means all told, we start getting, I mean, it is a very significant funding boost. It's not quite, we're not going to quite get double, but it's getting up there. It's probably about almost 75, if you add up all these different funding sources that give us more money due to free reduced or what have you, or unduplicated count students, we start getting up to maybe 75% additional revenue because of that demographic in our particular situation, because we're such a high count. So it's very significant. Just circling back to federal revenue, Title I revenues, nothing has really changed there, but they give us additional money for the free and reduced count students. And so that's a fairly significant funding source for us due to our demographics. Title II is for professional development. Title III is for English learners. And Title IV, I mean, is relatively new and is a real surprise to me because it's to me, it's almost, you can spend it on anything. They just give additional money to effectively every school. It's probably about, we receive probably the minimum amount, which is a $10,000 grant for each of our schools there. So not huge, but something. This title funds for federal, there are strings attached, however. There's a two-part kind of annual application and reporting process with it. And I'm sorry, there are, I know, just unending numbers of acronyms here. But this one is called the CARS system, or Consolidated Application Reporting System. So that, you know, one has to apply in both June and February to the system. There's a little bit of other reporting. And in addition, now with all this LCAP work, and the board is probably either very familiar or getting familiar with this LCAP, if given that we pursue federal funds, the state also wants us to put in our LCAP, our local control and accountability plan, additional information about how we're spending these title funds. So that's another kind of piece of the strings attached to federal revenue. On other federal revenues, there's the special education piece that I mentioned earlier. Please note that this is smaller than the state piece, of course, but you know, $125 per every ADA is still significant, and that helps us. There's also federal meal reimbursements. And then occasionally there are additional programs. One that I thought might be applicable to us, Doreen, do we get federal impact aid funding? Do you happen to know?
No, we do not.
Okay. Nope. Some federal impact aid, just a word on it. And so I don't know if this is applicable. I mean, obviously we're not currently getting this funding, but this money, the intent of this federal impact aid is to give money from the federal government to schools or school districts if the federal government is impacting local property taxes in some way. So that sounds kind of hard to understand. But what that means is if there's a large military base nearby, and therefore, because the local entities cannot tax that military base, that would impact local property taxes and therefore impact local district funding in most cases. So if there is a large number of kids of ours that say lived on a military base or had parents that worked on a military base, et cetera, or tribal lands. So I thought that might also possibly be applicable to us. If that adds up to enough number of kids, it's a pain to get into this program, but then once you get into the program, it could be, you know, hopefully decent enough dollars, and it's kind of on, not autopilot, but the hard part's getting into the program. So Doreen, do you think that we have these, you know, either military bases nearby that might be, you know, related to our families or tribal lands?
So we had looked at that initially with El Centro way, way back, and we didn't have enough to qualify, but it does, it goes without saying, it doesn't, we can definitely look at it again. We haven't looked at it for San Bernardino, so potentially there.
Yeah. Well, it's just a program I like to mention because it's a little off the beaten path, but if it is applicable, it can yield decent dollars for us. So at least wanted to mention that. And the REAP one, I don't think would probably be applicable to us. That is a rural program. I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, perhaps it could, now I think about it, could apply to El Centro. There's official designation that we might be able to look into that. But Doreen, have you ever heard of the REAP program?
I have. And at the time, I don't think we qualified either. But again, it definitely bears, you know, further review.
Okay. No, and again, just wanted to mention it. If you've already looked into it, then it's less likely that it's changed since then. But okay, moving on from federal, unless there are questions. So local revenues. So last kind of section of revenues is local revenues. Local revenues are typically small, but can fill in strategic funding gaps. I mean, some schools do a whole lot of fundraising. Some do not, but it can be occasionally helpful. So I don't know. It's probably less of a fit given our family demographics. I don't know if we do significant fundraising. But I did want to mention that non-academic discretionary programs can charge fees, by the way. So it can't be anything that is really academically related, but childcare and after-school clubs can conceivably charge fees for additional service. So any questions on revenues before I move on? Okay, we'll move on then. Next topic is cash flow. Now, this is just almost an uncomprehensibly complicated map here, but this does provide the detail if anyone wanted it. The big picture here is that the state funding program here, try to make it a little bit bigger in case anyone's having trouble seeing that. So the most of our funds, our local control funding formula and some other programs follow what is now a fairly easy to remember program. We get our cash flow schedule. We get 5% of our revenue in July, 5% in August, and then 9% effectively every single month after that. So that is the bulk of our funding is going to be here. Now there are, I mentioned with the local control funding formula, there is that EPA amount, and that actually pays out, and you know, and the only reason to know about those different pots of money is that there are different cash flow schedules. So here's where we see that. So that EPA amount gets paid out on a quarterly basis. So there's just four boxes here. And then lastly, and then the local control, I'm sorry, the in lieu of local property taxes have their own schedule. It's slightly more complicated than the, you know, the 559 from the state, and I give the percentages here, but it's fairly close to, you know, providing funding on a, you know, fairly smooth basis throughout the year. It's not too bad. It's not nothing like the quarterly payment. You know, you get a payment every single month, for instance. Now, I also wanted to mention here is those P1 and P2 average daily attendance periods here. So P1, if you think about it, well, if I'm saying they're paying us 5%, 5%, 9% for, say, our state aid of local control funding formula, well, 5% of what? Well, they will take what is our prior year, what's called P2 data, and they'll use that temporarily until they get new average daily attendance data to overwrite that. And that new average daily attendance rate for the current year, so let's just say for 21-22, in December, we ended what's called P1, and that is the first period of attendance. That is from the first day of school through, I believe it's January 15th or so. And in January, we report out our average daily attendance, and that is what serves as the basis for next several payments until the next period of attendance, which is P2. Now, P2 is really, at the end of the day, almost the only attendance period that we care about. There's a couple exceptions. I mentioned the lottery one. But P2 is the first day of school all the way through roughly about April 10th or so. It depends upon our particular instructional calendar. But more or less, attendance could just drop off a cliff. It's almost, I know educationally, of course, we don't believe this, but from a funding perspective, kids could just all skip school starting April 15th, and it has no funding effect upon us, because just about everything is based upon this P2 amount, which is the first day of school through about April 10th or so. So that is P2. And that P2 serves as the basis for the final payments for our fiscal year, say for 21-22, and the beginning payments for the next year. Now, it'll get all settled up again once you have P1 for next year, and then finally P2 will be the final determinant for next year. But P2 from this year serves as the temporary placeholder for a good chunk of next year's payments. So sorry to be so confusing. That is a very complicated topic. If anyone has questions, I'm happy to try to answer them before moving on. Okay. Okay, so that's just, again, high level on cash flow. Our cash flow position seemed pretty strong to me. So we're probably not sweating a lot of these details, but I wanted to give you the big picture there. Okay. I'll just talk about a couple of the exceptions. I already mentioned the education protection account. Lottery is also paid out quarterly, and it's one quarter late. So the last April through June 2021 payment, so from this past fiscal year, was only paid in September 2021, just to give you an example. So it's a quarter late. I give you some resources in case anyone did want to find the schedules and the cash flow, but I don't think we need to go into that level of detail at the board level here. Okay, and then, so that's just a little bit on revenues and cash flow. And then just a little bit about at the board level, what I thought would be important and that you probably are looking at as far as financial information that goes up to the board level. So the first report that I think it's important for the board to look at least occasionally, say at the what's called the first interim and second interim, which we'll talk about in a second, is a year-to-date actual to budget. So all this is showing, it's almost like an income statement. That's so small, it might be hard to read. And this is what our particular report looks like. So this is our actual, let's pick September. So September, this is our actual amounts in this column for both revenues. And if we scroll down on the actual report, the expenses also, and then our budgeted amounts for each of those amounts for revenues and expenses. And, to me, the first few months are going to be, hard to get right perfectly, because, each of these budgeted monthly amounts is a prediction. You have to get pretty precise on some of those predictions. But say by December or January, you should be, those fluctuations should be from month to month, should be evening out. And you should be making sure that you're on track as far as receiving as much revenue as you think and budgeted that you were going to versus your budget, especially on, say, local revenue amounts. Like if there were fundraising or, say, after school care costs or revenues, you want to make sure those are on track to make sure that you're not going to miss for the year by a large amount. So that's the first report. Again, it shows revenue, expenses, and the profit or surplus or loss per month. And it broadly tells the school, in my opinion, and board, where funds will come from and where they will be spent, and often used in yearly budgeting. And then there's interim monthly statements to track year-to-date progress against the budget. Again, that's this report right here that perhaps you all see. So that's one, to me, critical kind of board level budget report that the board should hopefully be looking at least a few times a year and maybe on a monthly basis. The other piece to that I think is critical to look at is what's called the balance sheet. And the balance sheet's a little harder. I think most of us can understand something like this, you know, because it's not that far from our own individual experience in life, where, you know, we have income from getting paid for our job, and we have expenses going out the door from, you know, rent or mortgage and paying for food. So, you know, I think we kind of intuitively understand what's called the income statement a little bit more easily. But the balance sheet's a little bit more odd, I think. What a balance sheet tries to do is saying, okay, at the, let's just say, at the end of April 2022, how much stuff does Ballington own, and how many people does it owe in return? So it's just trying to list off, first of all, the and here, let's just look at it again. Maybe this is going to be hard to see. But it's going to list off, first of all, cash. That's the most important aspect there. And then whether anyone owes us money, that's called accounts receivable. And then it's going to have a category called fixed assets, which is just how much money we've put into our facilities. And if we own, say, computers and other items, some of that amount that we think that that's effectively worth would be listed here. On the other end, people that we owe, there's a current liability section, and current liabilities is we think we have to pay these debts within the year. So that's the term current. And so accounts payable, that's all that's effectively just who we owe right now. So just bills we've received but haven't, and we've entered into the accounting system but haven't yet paid. And then sometimes there are deposits held on behalf of employees or teachers for their, if they elect to receive their payments 12 months, in other words, I'm sorry, their salary over 12 months instead of 10 months, that would be listed here. And if we had any long-term liabilities, like loans, like building loans, that would be listed under long-term liabilities because they are anticipated to be paid off after a 1 year's time. So you take total assets, you subtract our liabilities, and that would get us our net assets. In other words, that's what, you know, broadly speaking, what people think our organization is worth, because we have all this cash, we own some things, but we owe some people some aspects. And so that would be net assets at the end of the day. So to me, that would be the other major report that you would want to see on a regular basis, just to make sure we aren't ballooning in our liabilities and that we have enough cash on hand to pay our bills. Okay, so just some other red flags I thought might be helpful at the board level to keep in mind. So cash is just critically important. And several times, I mean, maybe several board members might remember, but several times in the past, when the state runs into fiscal problems, you know, like a recession, what it will do, it will, because the K-12 system in California is about 40% of the entire state budget. It's by far the largest single chunk. And so if the state is having trouble getting its own money from, you know, tax receipts, because there's just a recession going on and fewer people are working, therefore paying into, you know, state taxes. So if the state is getting less cash, what they have started to use during my tenure helping charter schools, and the first time I saw it, I was like, oh boy, this was so easy, they're gonna do this again, is what's called deferrals. So they will say, oh yeah, you'll get your full funding rates that we promised you, but we're just going to have to delay when we actually pay you the cash. And so if you have a strong cash position as, you know, a Ballington school in of itself, if you have enough cash to ride this out, this is not a terrible deal because, you know, you don't need the cash immediately. And because the state will pay you back someday, then you still get to count it. And count it for annual financial purposes and on your balance sheet, et cetera, et cetera. So that is much better than the alternative, which the alternative is like the state says, well, gosh, we have to cut K-12 funding rates by 10%. Well, that would, of course, hurt us because we would be getting 10% less money for teaching, say, the same number of kids. So that deferral strategy is, it's just a go-to tactic at this point for the state. And so it points to the reason why, to me, it's important to have cash. Now, as an aside, and I'll try not to bore you with too many details here, the state has now come in for districts, okay, for school districts, not for us, but just in case you start running into this mentality by local school districts saying, like, well, you guys have too much cash. The state has now said, okay, we are going to fund our own couple of rainy day funds at the state level. There is both a general state rainy day fund and a K-12 specific one. And the general state budget one, I think, has about $15 billion in it. And the state and the one that's just for K-12 has, I believe, about $2 billion in it. So that is supposed to make everyone feel okay about, hey, if the state runs into a recession, don't worry, we can use these rainy day funds to fill in the gap. Well, and it's very significant amounts of money. I mean, you know, I applaud politicians for putting aside, in this case, about $17 billion that they would otherwise much rather spend and get, you know, political credit for. So that's a good thing. But please know that when we've run into bad financial times, like in the Great Recession, you know, state tax receipts went down by, you know, $30 billion in 1 year. And so the entire rainy day fund would not, the rainy day funds can handle small blips. It cannot handle huge blips. And so And yet the state has now said, because we have these rainy day funds, districts can no longer have more than 10% savings set aside. They have to spend it. They can't just keep cash around. And I can somewhat understand it, other than the caveat I just gave you, where a really big recession is going to exhaust those rainy day funds at the state level fairly quickly. So I'm glad that it is not applicable to charter schools, and I'm glad that we have additional cash. So it's something to keep an eye on an ongoing basis, in my opinion. So we talked the next couple of items. We talked about briefly accounts receivable, who owes us money. So just trying to make sure that we actually get those funds without, you know, without it being like a 6 month kind of delay, or after 6 months after the fiscal year, hopefully that we've gotten paid by the government. And by the way, the feds are pretty much the worst on this. The feds effectively operate on a reimbursement basis, where we have to spend the money, report the money as spent, and then sometime after, oftentimes not even that timely, they will therefore write us a check for what we have spent. So the feds are not good on this. Accounts payable, just making sure that we pay our own debts on time, or if we're getting really strapped for cash, this is something you can kind of play with, where you're not paying your bills on time and people start getting unhappy with you, but you know, you pay them eventually. I didn't see significant long-term debt on our part, but you know, really only reason to take on long-term debt, in my opinion, is to fund, you know, facility acquisition or major renovation kind of programs. So those are just a couple things. Oh, and then enrollment and average daily attendance. I kind of mentioned the average daily attendance, how critical that is at the beginning of this session. But of course, enrollment is also critically important. I think if enrollment and ADA are moving around at all, I would want to hear about it on a monthly basis at the board level. So just getting updates like, yes, we are on track on enrollment in ADA, or we're actually 2% over, or we're 5% down. I would want to hear all that. I think that is very important for the reasons that we just learned about, is how much it underlies our funding. So we talked about some of this reserve aspects here. I think it's great to have about 3 months worth of cash or more that we can fall back upon for these cash flow delays. And I think we were above that from what I quickly looked at. So I think we're okay on that. Great. And then last, I think the last topic I wanted to talk about is just what I would call the externally required financial reports. So these are some of these financial reports that you as a board will be asked to approve. And I just wanted to make sure you understand, broadly speaking, what was being asked of you and what these reports are. So the overall intent of each budget report is to ensure the charter school is keeping its budget up to date and tracking actuals versus budget. So again, these are some of those financial reports I was recommending on an internal basis that you keep an eye on. These reports are due to and should be reviewed by the charter granting agency, usually the local district, and the county office of education. So sometimes this could be, some districts are very stringent and really go over this with a fine tooth comb and can be very time consuming. Others are less so. My impression is that San Bernardino is fairly time consuming. Would you agree, Doreen?
Yes. And El Centro is time consuming in the respect of very detailed oriented. They really look at all of the numbers and tie them to prior numbers. So equally, they do not ask for as much. Pretty much it's LCF calculator and the interim report, where San Bernardino asks for chart of accounts, bank statements, you know, probably our packet to them is over 100 pages time submit, you know, an interim, but I think equally in their own right, they are just as time consuming.
Okay. Well, in many regards, I'm sorry to hear it, because it can be very time consuming. And frankly, I wonder who is really looking at these reports and whether they look at it that closely or whether they just want to be able to check mark the box, like, okay, we got like 15 reports from these guys. So my sympathies. Many districts do require these reports for the official kind of state level due date, but I will just present the kind of official due dates, but just know that our due dates are going to be almost always before what I'm officially saying here. So just to outline the total process. So it starts with the annual budget for the current fiscal year. It's technically due July 1st. We're probably approving that at our June board meeting. And that's the initial budget. Then what's called the first interim report. So this is, you know, indeed it's the first such report, and it's just during the year, hence the term interim. It's going to show any revisions to the budget and actuals through the end of October. And it's due December 15th. Again, it's probably due earlier for us. Although the purported reason is showing actuals through the end of October, really, I think the point of this report is to force, and this is required of districts also, force school districts and charter schools to change and revise and update their budget, in roughly in the kind of November, December timeframe. The second interim is the second such report, and that shows any revisions to the budget really through, and you're probably working on this in February, and showing the actuals through the end of January, and it's due in the middle of March. So we might be approving that either in early March kind of board meeting or in February. And again, sometimes, I think we just heard from Doreen that maybe both of our authorizers require a lot of additional detail here, unfortunately. But those are two during the year financial reports. And then just to finish off the process for a particular fiscal year, what's called the unaudited actuals for the previous fiscal year is due on September 15th, again, probably earlier for us. And so that's what we think are our final. So let's say by September 15th, we have to submit this unaudited actuals report, and it's going to show what we think are our finalized numbers for the, say, 21-22 fiscal year, and we would submit them in September 2022. And then lastly, the final word on a particular year's fiscal numbers is the audit, and that audit is due normally December 15th, although the pandemic pushed that back for the last couple of years, but I think they'll stick to December 15th this upcoming cycle. But that's the traditional due date. And that is the final and kind of official word on your, say, 21-22 fiscal number. So in December 2022, we should have our audit done and we will submit it to our authorizers and goes up to the state in that case. Okay, and those are the required financial reports that I thought would be important to for everyone to know. And that is about just about 45 minutes. So that actually, I didn't think we'd be that close to 45 minutes and we're right around that. So I'm sorry, that was a lot of talking at you right there. And although there was a couple brave questions that were floated, I just want to encourage you to ask any other questions you might have before ending our session together.
Mr. Dennerson, this is Shannon Brander. I'm the principal at San Bernardino. I was wondering if you could explain to the board a little bit about the hold harmless issue that's on the table right now for this school year and possibly next school year.
I will try.
I've tried and I don't think I have my head completely around it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so generally, school districts and charter schools are paid the same way with this error. I'm going to stop sharing because I don't think we need my screen. Okay. Generally speaking, everyone is paid on that P2 basis that I mentioned to everyone, right? Well, then the pandemic came and just threw a wrench in that. So the pandemic was declared in March 2020. And so that cut off the last month and a little bit of normal attendance for that fiscal year, for the 1920 fiscal year. So in that fiscal year, what the state said is, look, we had a pretty normal attendance session through the end of February. We'll just go with that. So we won't go through, you know, mid-April or so, we'll go through the end of February. So I think that's what, that's my recollection of what we did that year. And then going into the next fiscal year, so 2021, they just said, okay, everyone is remote. How we do attendance reporting? Well, they said, don't worry about it. Just use prior year actuals. Okay, so that makes sense to me, right? Like that's the best available information there. Now we're in 21-22 and basically everyone is back into fairly normal, I mean, not completely normal, but fairly normal attendance, et cetera. And so we are, so charter schools are reporting normal attendance and districts are also. But the pandemic, so the districts say, oh my gosh, people have moved out of state and they aren't coming back. They're still homeschooling. So we've actually been decreasing our enrollment statewide for a very long time, but usually goes down by like 1 or 2% per year. It's gone down by a stair step last year and continued this year. People were hoping it was going to spike back up. It didn't do that. It continued to decrease by a little bit. So I think we went down by, I think, 8% during 2021. And then I think we went down by, I'm doing this off the top of my head, but I think we went down by another 3%, I think overall, statewide this year. So it's very significant. So the districts are like, whoa, you're gonna cut our funding and we're already, we're gonna have terrible attendance, therefore you're gonna pay us less, all that. So the districts are trying to say, hey, pay us on the basis of, they're just trying to get whatever they can, in my opinion, right? So they're saying, oh, we could either use the average of 2 years ago and 3 years ago, or we could use the highest of the last year or this year. You know, they're just trying to get whatever they can attendance-wise, the best deal. Now, the governor, and so that was floated in the governor's January budget proposal, which was indeed released in January. He then says for charter schools, says, well, and we'll talk about it for charter schools. Well, I mean, to me, it just means he's not very charter. Well, all right, honestly, I mean, I'm going on a tangent here. In my heart, I think he actually likes charter schools. But I think he just, he's in the pocket of the teachers unions. And so he does what they tell him to do. And And so he said, charter schools, you know, we can talk about it with charter schools. But I mean, to me, if he's, I mean, if he honestly wanted to hear about potential solutions, he could have just proposed it, like he did for the school districts. Like just say charter schools and districts can use either 3 years ago or the average of 2 and 3 years, you know, this complicated kind of formula. So I'm personally not that hopeful, unfortunately, that we will get such favorable hold harmless kind of treatment. Now, big picture, by the way, all it is delaying slightly the inevitable for the school districts. So yes, it absolutely would be helpful if we got it to be helpful to school districts if they do get it. But long and short of it, it's just giving them a little bit more time to like ramp down their funding. And, you know, so it's not a panacea or anything like that. It's just a delaying tactic. But that is the proposal on the table. It's nothing official right now. I'm sorry if that was way too long, but I wanted to editorialize.
No, well, I thought that was great. Yeah, Thank you.
The reason I asked about that specifically is because if it does pass, we'll know, what is it, by end of next month, and it will have such a significant impact on cash flow and our bottom line for this school year.
I mean, if it happens, then great, right? I just wouldn't be counting on it. They absolutely could do it. There's the state is getting such great actual tax revenue. They have lots of money on the table they could choose to spend in many different ways. So they absolutely could do this. But I wouldn't bet on it for charter schools. I'll just put it that way. If it happens, great. And then we can, you know, up our budgets. But I wouldn't count on it on at this point.
And specifically, board members, as you recall, for El Centro, we had to really rework our budget based on the significant under enrollment we had, which led us to a change in some of our staffing design there.
Well, I'm sorry to hear it. When did you feel like you got visibility into that?
Oh, we got it probably the first quarter in. So we made pretty quick intentional changes. I want to say by October, November.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
On that, we were hopeful the first, you know, we start in August, and we were hopeful, you know, the August, September, we kind of go up and down. We were hopeful we would recruit back by, you know, beginning of October. We knew we needed to make a change because we weren't going to recoup the amount that we needed to recoup to make us okay.
Well, just continue to keep a really close eye on it, just like you are, because, you know, we're all trying to figure this out, frankly, and it's hard to predict with this pandemic. I mean, it's just another curveball from the pandemic, frankly, right?
And it also just a mention on the financial statements. I know that some of us are used to nonprofit accounting, where we accrue the revenue. Unlike in school accounting, I believe they report the revenue as cash basis versus accrual, correct?
I mean, it's a great question. To me, it's actually varied a little bit over time. And because we didn't used to get all these weird revenue sources that would arrive in 1 year, but really be spent in another year, that's really been happening to a great extent with all these federal stimulus programs and other kind of state pandemic relief programs. And so now, I've really been pushing us, and I think, and we've been in turn reaching out to auditors, and I think we've all gone on the same page that generally speaking, we should be matching revenues to the expenses. In other words, we will be deferring the revenues or putting it into a restricted net asset to match the expenses if it happens in a further fiscal year. So it varies a little bit by program, but we are as much as possible trying to match when we have the revenues to be counted in the same year as the expenses are booked, so that you don't have these blips up and down that have to be explained to the board, like, oh, you know, we got the cash early, but now we have the expenses in this fiscal year. So we're doing our best on that, and we think we got most of the auditors on board on that.
you. Board members, do you have any questions? Any topic you want to dive deeper into?
If I could bring up one other program, maybe just a couple sentences, the what's called the Expanded Learning Opportunity Program. I don't know if you all have gone into this, but this, well, I'm sorry, if this is
we not, wish we could decline it. The principal and I wish we could decline it, but we know we can't.
Oh boy. Okay. I want to say, so everyone says you can't refuse the money. You can't refuse the money. What I think actually they mean is that there's no way to opt out of the money and just never get it. But what I assume, if you communicated closely with your auditor, and you'd have to kind of get their blessing on this, but if you said, hey, auditor, we're not planning on spending this money. I mean, we're going to return it, et cetera, et cetera. Could you make sure that doesn't, can you make it sound like, you know, we are intentionally doing so, not that we just like dropped the ball and didn't fulfill the requirements of this call, this ELOP program. So that might be on the table. And that's what I was thinking lots of people would do. So I should back up. So this Expanded Learning Opportunity Program is effectively a before and after school tutoring program. And you know, it can be enrichment activities, it doesn't have to be academic, in fact. But it also requires at least 30 additional days. And so, and it started this year. So we got money this year for this program, but I don't know of a single, I haven't heard of a single charter school, just to make you feel better, that's tried to get this program off the ground this year. So the state said, hey, we're giving you the money, but you can spend it next year. All right. Now, if that were the end of it, then I would hope that, I don't know, either we run the program 1 year or maybe we're able to get the auditor to be okay with us kind of returning the funds and not spending it. However, now this ELOP program is really one of the darlings of Gavin Newsom. And he really proposing throwing a lot of money at this program for multiple years. And it's kind of getting to the point where I feel like you can't say no, unfortunately. So I'm sorry, I know it's a pain at the school level, absolutely. And no one's doing it this year because it's such a pain to try to hire for or figure out. But nevertheless, there's so much money going towards this program. I think it's the offer you can't refuse. And you might want to start looking at how to run such a program next year. My apologies, but that.
No, that's okay. We got a plan and we're ready. We're just, you know, it's one of those things where we're like, just so upset, just all along the way, right? We've identified the 30 extra days. We've identified the 9 hours a day. For us as charters, we're even like looking at, you know, our charter petition, because our charter petition alone offers more than the minimum required days. Yeah. We know we can't count those. So we're just, then we're trying to gear up and try.
Wait, just to pause you there. I had another client that was in the same situation where they're doing it, you know, 183 days or whatever already. And they wanted to know whether anything over 100, it honestly, I looked into it quite closely. I honestly think it could be read either way. I think it could be that anything over 175 could count towards the 30. Great. And but it's just not like, honestly, I looked at the law, I looked at the actual language. I think that's what they're saying, but I want there to be an official state FAQ kind of clarifying that. And they haven't quite done that yet. Anyway, so I'm keeping my fingers crossed that maybe people like you will be able to count anything over 175 already. Now, just to give you the other perspective on it, because I agree with you, and again, no charter school has been able to get this program off the ground. That's how much of a pain it is. Now, the other side of the coin, I've always thought, and probably many of you have also thought, like, what a ridiculous school schedule we have, right? Like, it's based upon, you know, I mean, like a 1950s, you know, black and white TV family that has a, you know, frankly, a mom to pick up kids at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock and that can take care of them over the summer. I mean, it's just not, I mean, I don't know how single parents do it. I don't know how, you know, two working parents do it. And that, so I think this is an attempt to try to give an option for kids to have a safe place to be when their family is working. So not quite the entire year round, but, you know, a good chunk of it. And, you know, until their parents can pick them up at 6 o'clock at night or what have you. Anyway, so from a parent perspective, I really appreciate the program. But from an operational perspective, it's such a pain. I totally, like, I've seen, I've heard of schools trying to, like, say, hey, we'll give teachers stipends. We'll give, you know, we'll give extra money as a bounty to do this. And they just didn't have takers.
No.
And it's just hard to, it's just.
Teachers are tired. They're tired.
But I want to jump in and reassure the board a little bit, because you're hearing doomsday with this program. And we're really okay. It's not. We're really okay. Like Doreen said, we've identified the days. I can't speak for Mr. Anderson, but I've identified the staff, the schedule, things like that. It wasn't the easiest task, and there's still a few things to iron out, like getting the building ready for next year, if there's kids in it all summer, like little operational things like that. But I want to reassure the board that we're okay with this.
Okay. Well, my apologies. I've been too doom and gloom. I was trying to share that everyone is having difficulties with this program. So if you are also, you should not feel bad. So.
Yeah, it's not easy. I'm not going to lie. It's not easy, but we're okay.
Yeah.
We all had our moments, I think. And we actually scheduled, I want to say, two sessions where we could just kick it all out and be upset. And then we decided to operationalize.
You guys are hugging, crying.
No. Oh my gosh. And then Shan, like, much like Mr. Anderson, he has already figured out even route into the program so that he can still continue to do all his building maintenance during the summer. He's identified who's going to manage the program. I think that honestly was the toughest, just because staffing in a normal time frame, you know, this year has just been such a challenge.
Yeah.
So getting the extended staff would, I think, took a lot of time. We all had the discussion of, we just don't want it to be childcare. We want it to actually be enhancement and use it as an opportunity. So just looking at the curriculum and what were we going to offer?
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
Perhaps the last thing I want to leave you with is a term I just heard yesterday that maybe puts this into perspective or give you some sympathy. So it's called I believe we're in the middle of a plandemic with all these different plans that they have required of us and of your staff and of, frankly, of the board to review and consider and approve. I mean, it's a ridiculous number of plans. It's probably been like a dozen different new plans, and the LCAP is more substantive than ever, et cetera. So please give the staff some sympathy as they're trying to get through this whole process here. My apologies that I am now slightly over an hour. I'm happy to answer questions, but I feel bad for taking up so much of your time.
Well, on behalf of the board, thank you very much for your explanation. It was very much down to earth and easy to understand.
Good.
Thank you.
Yeah, really fantastic. Thank you.
Okay, great. Okay, well, thank you very much, everybody. Have a great rest of your board meeting. And Doreen knows where to get a hold of me if you have any additional questions or anything else.
Thank you so much once again. Much great. Appreciated. Thank
great
you.
Great to see you again, Doreen.
Absolutely. Good to see you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Be safe.
Well, that was great. That was a lot.
It's a lot. And it's very detailed as well, you know, between even within the LCFF funding, there's the base and the concentration and the supplemental. And so it gets pretty detailed. But I hope it gave everyone just a 101 as well as some of the terms.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I know, Christy, you had a question about special education.
Yeah.
So I can, if we have a few minutes, I can begin to try to explain this.
I'll just, I, I texted Doreen because I wasn't sure if I was missing something when he was talking about the SELPA. I texted her. I said, it sounds like I take your lunch money, I buy you lunch, or I give you lunch, and then I charge you for it. So I didn't really understand the concept.
I think that's pretty accurate for San Bernardino.
Well, that's what it sounded like to me. And Doreen said, not exactly. Maybe we could discuss later.
Not exactly.
So I'm going to probably speak very high level. So we are obligated to provide special education services. Historically, special education services have been very costly. I'll say costly, and very tied to legal, right? They're highly litigious, especially with the rights involved, lots and lots of regulations around special education. So as a charter school, usually, and we actually have—
I have to go, sorry.
Oh, that's okay, Ms. Carla, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So as a charter school, we've had the opportunity, actually we do both models at this point. In our El Centro, we're our own school of special education. Mm-hmm. So the positive with that is that yes, we get the money directly from the state, and then we get to hire our own staffing. And we have to be able to offer everything related to special education services. So that means, you know, a special education coordinator, special education teacher, based on some of the students' IEPs, if they require occupational therapist, we have to be able to hire that or mm-hmm. contract out, so to speak, access that. School psychologist, you know, speech, hearing, all of whatever is in the child's IEP. And that works for El Centro. The challenges have been obviously staffing, right? Because mm-hmm. at this point, the district says, you have all the money, you work it out. We don't care if you can't find a special education teacher. You are held accountable for this. You are accountable for anything related in that IEP and everything single service you got. For example, if it's written into the IEP, if the child needs transportation or if they require a special day class, you're on the hook. You have to work that out. You figure out a way. You know, as a small charter school, that has been challenging.
I bet, yeah.
If the least, and this is going very deep, and I'm trying to make it as simplistic as possible, but there's a thing called least restrictive environment where they determine what best educational setting is for the student. Sometimes, knock on wood, it'll be a non-public school. And that means the charter, we have been fortunate. I'm knocking on wood. That means that the charter school is required to pay for that non-public school placement, which is could be thousands a month, right? Thousands and thousands a month. So definitely quickly your revenue that you receive for special education services by the time you pay for all the staffing and if there's any extraordinary placements, you have to pay for that. Any of the legal fees, you're responsible for that. It falls on you because essentially you're standalone, right?
Right. You're just responsible for everything. You got to figure it out.
And we were with, our authorizer, initially, I will share with you, it was a challenge. They held to the, here's your money. We don't want to enter any action. We don't even want you to call us for technical assistance. You problem solve it. We're not there for you, right?
Right.
That led us to, this is a couple years ago, we actually then elected to join a charter school, SELPA. So that is why
that makes sense.
El Centro does not, normally we would be with El Centro as our self, but because of our location and mm-hmm. vicinity. However, because we needed really as a small charter school, we needed more support. We opted to go with the charter school SELPA. We still have to provide all of our own staffing, but unlike our previous SELPA, they do provide a little bit more technical assistance. For mm-hmm. example, there was a due process situation. Their attorneys did step in and help us. We had to pay for some, but they helped us also on some guidance there. So that has worked out very well. We did have at one point we have been extremely fortunate. We did have a high needs child that would have qualified for a more restrictive placement. Happened that year that the Imperial County, we were able to connect with a new program that we were able to opt him in. We still were responsible for, even though he didn't come to our school anymore, because we were his school of his home school, we were responsible for coordinating transportation and mm-hmm. such. So overall, we've been very lucky. I've heard stories of not the case where right. Special education actually could rep a charter school. So that's that one model where we get the services and we provide all of our staffing. That's been our glitches there. On the other hand, San Bernardino has the model where a school of the district for special education services. And that is where the district keeps all of our funding, but they also provide all the services. All of knock on wood, should there be a legal situation, they step in. Now, granted, Shannon and I do reach out to our attorney on certain situations just to make sure the charter school is protected. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, they have shared with us, yeah, that falls on the district. That falls on the district because you're a school of their district right. for special education services. And this has occurred for us in the past. We had a challenging IEP or a challenging situation with one of the students. District came out. They were represented. They arranged all the transportation and they followed the student through. Some of the challenges, of course, are they're not your staff. So, you know, you're at their whims. And then in addition to that, because San Bernardino special education is so expensive, they oftentimes, you're in a pool with all of the schools that have all of the different special education issues, and that requires them to charge you an additional amount, which we call encroachment, because the cost of special education is more than the funding. So they charge us a cost per child on there. And that's because they've had some pretty significant special education situations. So those are the two models. I think that there's pros and cons. Mm-hmm. I think in El Centro, knock on wood, thankfully, we haven't had any high need situations. And hats off to Mr. Anderson, because he has done a phenomenal job on just partnering with actually the county, Imperial County Office of Ed, for all, you know, they've allowed us to contract with them. And even so, between our contract with them, the hiring of our own staff person, knock on wood, we actually spend more than the special education funding. So we do encroach into our own
on your own
in general ed right. budget. Ultimately,
but like for a public school in San Bernardino, if they spent more than the allotment, what happens to them?
They pay the encroachment as well.
Oh, they do.
They pay the encroachment as well. So that's how they determine it. They say, this is our special education budget. And I'm making it very, very simplistic. They have
it to be simplistic.
They have a very complicated formula. They say, this is our special education budget. our revenue. This is how much we cost. It's $100,000 over the funding. We've got 10 schools. Each of you are going to pay, you know, the $10,000.
Okay. Thank you.
Something else that I think is unique to San Bernardino. The San Bernardino district is so large that it created its own SELPA. So we do that pass-through model that she was talking about, where the San Bernardino City Unified SELPA provides services. So it's technically not the district, because like Doreen was saying, they're different budgets. And the way San Bernardino Unified chose to do it is they're completely different entities. So the San Bernardino Unified SELPA is one entity and the district is another entity. But when you have districts that are a little bit smaller, there might be multiple districts that join another SELPA, like one that's local to us is the West End SELPA. And I want to say there's like 7 districts that participate in that.
Oh, okay.
So if a district does spend more than they receive, there's encroachment that goes to that SELPA that they belong to.
Interesting. Okay. Well, thank you. I think I get it now.
It definitely is pros and cons. And I will share with you the impetus, honestly, for transitioning out of El Centro's authorizer as our SELPA, or the Imperial County as our SELPA, really was, well, they were providing minimal technical assistance, but ultimately they had at one point asked us to pay encroachment. And that was like, no, if we're going to pay encroachment, then you assume all risk. And they're like, no, we're not assuming any of the risk. And that was when like, oh, no. That's why we're paying to assume the risk. And I know that San Bernardino City, where San Bernardino's, you know, we're a member of their SELPA. I know there's been challenges there too, and they've had challenges with staffing and inconsistencies there as well. So definitely it special education, it is a significant area that does take a lot of your time.
Interesting. Thank you.
You are welcome.
I think I'm done with any questions.
Your mind, right? That was a lot.
That was great, though. I mean, really, I see what you mean by, you know, he just breaks it down and explains it in a way that is very understandable.
Definitely. Maybe next time we can have part 2.
There you go.
Digestible segments, right?
Right, right. So would you like to, or do we have any closing comments or anything else? I know I don't.
Okay. Ms. Dixie, do you have any?
No, I'm good. Thank you. I thought that was great.
Thank you. Great phone numbers. Well, thank you so much for staying on. I know we went a little bit over, and our next board meeting, it looks like, is May 24th. So we have a bit of a break.
The hiatus.
Yes, yes. But man, plan. Lots of plans, because we've got the ELO plan, the TK plan, the LCAP plan. All of those will be coming.
That's funny.
I know.
Not funny, haha.
Well, I know. I just thought of that. How insensitive that sounded. Like, it's funny to me. Not so funny to Shannon.
And during the pandemic, we got so used to, you know, developing the plans, and then the people that had to approve them just kind of checked it off and said, thank you. Oh, when did your board approve it? Oh, thank you. Okay. Well, our last one we submitted, we actually, there were questions, and it went back and forth a little bit, and we're like, they're reading them? What? Oh no, now they have time, right?
No rubber stamp here.
No.
Well, I've got 7:14 p.m. You want to call it?
Call it. Officially, and closed to the public, correct?
Adjourned.
All right, everyone. Thank you. And have a lovely rest of your April and a good beginning of the May.
Thanks, everyone. And Joseph, as always, thank you for your support in this.
Yeah, thank you, Joseph.
Sure thing. My pleasure.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Night.
Bye.